Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is not an exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Hello and welcome to Policy Forum Pod. I'm Anna Greta Hunter. I'm a cardiologist and physician, and I'm the Human Futures Fellow at the College of Health and Medicine here at the Australian National University.
And I'm Sharon Bessel. I'm Professor of Public Policy at the Crawford School, and I'm Professor of the Children's Policy Centre and the Poverty and Inequality Research Centre. And again, I'm on the road. I'm joining from Burnie in northwest Tasmania today, and my audio is not what it could be, and I don't have my normal big mic, so I'm hoping that the sound isn't too bad. And Anna Greta, I think you're on the road at the moment as well.
Yes, I'm also on the road. I'm in northern Victoria at the moment, in the federal seat of Indi, one of my favourite places to be. It is wonderful to be out and about looking at the state of the environment, particularly with the rain that's on. But you're in storm territory there in Tasmania, I think, at the moment, Sharon. So we're hoping that your hotel room stays in one piece over the recording.
There is a lot of wind here at the moment. There is a big storm brewing, but I am in a particularly beautiful part of the world, so it is wonderful to be here. Of course, as our regular listeners know, Policy Forum Pod is based at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. As we mentioned last week, we're hosting a series of online program information seminars from the 10th to the 13th of October, where you can chat to Crawford experts about degree programs and the short courses that we offer. There is a lot there that you can find out about, and we have some incredibly exciting programs. So do check that out. You can visit crawford.anu.edu.au/study for more information, and we'll leave a link to that in the show notes. Anna Greta, I am really looking forward to this conversation today. Would you like to introduce us to what it is we're going to be talking about?
Well, this is the third in our bundle of episodes on education. In the first episode, we spoke to Professor Deborah Brennan and Leonora Rees about early childhood education and care and the undervaluing of that critically important service. Last week, Professor Kitty Terreal and Jennifer Scatterbowl joined us to explore the ways in which the education system, from early childhood through to high school, supports and includes vulnerable children and their families. And in that conversation, we heard about some very serious gaps, despite the commitment and the best efforts of teachers. Through both episodes, we've also heard the remarkable opportunities for children and their communities when the challenge of educating our children is approached through an inclusive and caring lens. This week, we will discuss the challenge from the perspective of teachers. Over the recent months, there's been a great deal of discussion about the crisis within the teaching profession, very high workloads, relatively low salaries, and the undervaluing of teachers by society are all factors driving teachers from the profession. And all of this has been intensified by enormous pressures that teachers have faced during the COVID lockdowns and restrictions. So today, we are looking at the challenges facing the teaching profession and exploring the changes that are needed to produce better experiences of both teaching and learning. To do that, we are joined by two outstanding guests, Dr. Alice Garner and Professor Pasi Sahlberg. I would love to hear the two of you introduce yourselves. Alice, could we start with you?
Sure. I'll start with the reason why I think I'm here, and that's because I'm someone who a couple of years ago stopped teaching. I was a career change teacher And before that, I'd been an academic historian, an actor and musician, and I continue to do those things now. But I suppose my qualification for contributing to this conversation is really about my teaching experience and why I stopped. I'm currently based at the University of Melbourne in the Melbourne Graduate School of Education as a researcher.
It's fantastic to have you with us, Alison. That's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the things that you've done. Parsi, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, of course. Thanks, first of all, for having me in this conversation. I think this is a really important topic. My name is Parsi. I came from Helsinki, Finland to Australia about 4 years ago. And my background is in teaching. So I was teaching in Finland for a while and then training, preparing these great Finnish teachers there for a number of years. And I spent time around the world in the United States and Italy and elsewhere in Europe. And I'm back now here to try to figure out how to fix this teaching crisis that we have. But it's good to be with you. And we need more of these conversations in this country.
Well, we'll see how much of this we can cover in the next 45 minutes or so. Alice, I'd love to start by getting some on-the-ground perspectives. And as you mentioned in your introduction, you have been a teacher. You're not teaching at the moment, but you have great insight into what a typical day might look like for a high school teacher in Australia. Could you take us through that?
Yeah, sure. Straight away, I think, you know, where do you begin? Because, of course, you turn up to school preparing yourself for the timetable of that particular day, but there's been a lot of work before that, and that work has been preparing lessons, collaborating with colleagues in many different areas, but also the work that's involved in getting to know your students, in contributing in other ways to school culture, whether it be through sort of leadership positions or extracurricular activities. So there's a whole kind of constellation of things that teachers are thinking about as they turn up to school. There's a combination of long-term planning and last-minute thoughts as you walk towards the classroom too. So sometimes you're making last-minute adjustments. You've just found out that half the class is going to be at a sports carnival, so you have to drop the lesson that you'd planned because you don't want the students to miss out. Who aren't going to be there. So then you quickly, you know, on the run, think up a different set of activities that might be good for the remaining group. You know, then you might kind of bump into someone in the hallway who says, oh, remember how we were talking about, you know, rewriting that curriculum? Can we talk, you know, so there's those sorts of things that are happening on the run all the time. And then you get into the classroom. And of course, the first thing you have to do is sort of establish an atmosphere that is going to enable kids to do some good work and to learn something. And that can look very different depending on the age, the subject, the time of day, and so on. So, you know, there's I guess there are many more things I could say, but even if you're not in the classroom, you are either constantly sort of getting ready for that next moment or following up on the things that arose, say, in yesterday's class, and it might be a quick bit of marking because you have to get something to a student by a certain time. And then at lunchtime, you might be meeting with students who are behind with their work or someone who's come to you to ask you for help on a project. You know, it sort of goes on. It's like it's a rolling, it's unlike any other job actually that I've had. And I know that every job throws things at people throughout the day. But my feeling is that teaching requires a kind of constant energy output that is really unusual. And perhaps an equivalent might be someone working in a hospital, I'm guessing, you know. But you get home absolutely exhausted. I used to go and lie down in my room with the lights off for a while before I could kind of come back out and be with my family and be a sort of normal human being. So it's compelling because it's different every day, and it requires you to work at many different levels, intellectual, emotional, you know, physical, everything's going on. So it's a wonderful job for those reasons as well, but it is deeply, it's extremely demanding and you need stamina.
Alice, thank you so much for mapping that so clearly. I'm actually in Northwest Tasmania at the moment and doing research with primary school age children, and have just spent 6 hours with them today. And, you know, the amount of focus and energy that's required to keep the engagement going is phenomenal. So that exhaustion that you describe, I feel after a couple of days, and I'm amazed and in awe of teachers who do that day in, day out, and keep children so engaged. It's an incredible achievement. But Percy, I wanted to turn to you. On last week's episode of the pod, we talked about the issues for some children and young people and family in terms of both access to and experience of education. And we discussed policy documents in Australia, such as the 2019 Alice Springs Declaration, which highlight equity and also excellence. Percy, I'd love to hear from you, how is and how should equity in education be defined?
Yeah, that's a great million-dollar question that I have been trying to convince the, for example, the Productivity Commission that is working on the next National School Reform Agreement to kind of accept and understand that we need to have a clear definition for what equity means. Otherwise, it continues to be a kind of a phrase or fashionable word that we include in every sentence that we want to do. I think, you know, one way to see the equity in education, first of all, we should look at the outcomes, the equity of education outcomes, the equality of opportunities. Often when we talk about equity of inputs, the access to good schools and good curriculum and good instruction and materials and those things. But, you know, equity of educational outcomes is when we look at how different children do in school, given their different, very different backgrounds. And they're basically two dimensions in my understanding of equity. One is what we call, sometimes call adequate education, that every child should have reach a minimum threshold education, whether it's a length of education or qualification that they complete, or different levels of education that they receive and achieve and attain throughout their schooling. So, for example, here in Australia, it's a common, and within the OECD, much of the rest of the world, really, the expectation is that this adequate education means 12 years of schooling, so completing some sort of senior upper secondary education. So that's one thing, that every child should have adequate education that will allow and enable them to live happy and good life in their own choosing, of course. But then the other one, this other dimension that is sometimes called a social equity, that means that the education outcomes across different socioeconomic groups or equity groups, if you wish, should be similar. In other words, that the average performance within these different equity groups should be similar, and distribution of the learning outcomes, however they are measured, should be similar as well. Which is not the case right now. If we look at the educational outcomes or performance of different social or equity groups here in Australia, for example, we can see that there's a huge achievement gap between our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children compared to the rest of the society. Or if we look at the socioeconomically disadvantaged students and their performance against the other kids, let alone the affluent children, that there's a huge performance difference. And the distribution actually is very similar across these different equity groups. The problem is that there is this achievement gap, which indicates that there is an inequity in the society. So what equity means, that we should work towards a situation where these average performances in different equity groups should be similar or close to similar, and the distribution of these outcomes within these different social groups should be similar. Then we would be closer to the overall equity of education outcomes. But, you know, as long as we remain not insisting that equity should be defined, for example, this way. It means that equity of education outcomes will continue to be very difficult to monitor and measure. And whenever something is difficult to monitor in the society or evaluate or measure, give a value to it, nobody will be held accountable. And this will be the one of the risks in the future, that if we don't have a proper definition for equity, then nobody will be held responsible for the equity or lack of it in the future.
Alice, at the beginning, you've mapped the typical day of a teacher quite beautifully to open this conversation. And it did remind me of the maybe organized chaos of a hospital environment that I've spent quite a bit of time in. And you've also begun to touch on the challenge of distributing and providing teaching and educational experiences to students who are at all sorts of different stages. I wonder if you could tell us just how challenging it is for a classroom teacher to achieve equity in the classroom environment, and what sort of factors might be contributing to greater equity.
Yeah, that's a huge question, because I think what happens is teachers go in with, you know, at the beginning of the year with a sort of, you know, you come out refreshed from a bit of a break, ready to sort of meet new students, and you get a certain amount of information about the students who are coming into your class, so you can make some preparations for various things that might affect the way they learn, and it might, in some cases, it might be disabilities that have been, you know, kind of not only diagnosed but shared with the school, because it's also important to note that in some cases there are students who might have learning disabilities or difficulties that haven't been flagged, or that their parents have chosen not to, for various reasons, share with the school. So you go in with a certain amount of information, but that's only useful up to a point, because sometimes labels can be misleading, and sometimes you might think that because someone has been identified as having a certain, perhaps whether it's a learning disability or it might be something in their kind of family situation that might impact on their school experience, you know, that isn't always an indicator of certain sets of behaviours or levels of understanding or anything. So there's no kind of simple, you know, system or kind of checklist that, you know, operates in a straightforward way. We're talking about people in all their complexity. And so you really do go in sort of starting at zero and trying to understand the students in your classroom. Now, you know, I was teaching in a state secondary school, and most of my classes had on average about 26 students. And, you know, it's hard to get to know that many people quickly. You can't do it straight away. You can make those first steps. But so I think what I'm trying to say here is that relationship building is absolutely essential to get to know the students and to find out what they need in order to thrive in the classroom. But there are a whole lot of things that slow that down and make it difficult. One of those is the number of students that you're trying to get to know and to set up, you know, learning activities for and monitor those learning activities and so on. But also sometimes there will be situations where students present with certain, you know, behaviours or whatever it might be that you don't really understand, and that often we haven't been trained to understand or to respond to. So often what teachers are doing is doing this quick, you know, behind the scenes sort of, oh, I need to know a bit more about that situation or that, you know, you're quickly doing some reading or finding colleagues that might know something. And so it's not as though you come into the classroom fully prepared with materials that will suit every kind of student. That it's almost impossible actually to do that, because you can't predict. So I guess, you know, one of the things that would have been helpful, I think, was more support for teachers in not only identifying but understanding how best to respond to a specific set of, you know, it's not always problems either. It can just be things about students that affect the way they learn. It's this complex thing, again, that is a constant learning process, and I feel that often we don't have the time or the support to really get on top of those things. I know there's a lot more that could be said, but I guess, you know, and more education support staff in the classroom would be brilliant, because in my experience, you usually occasionally had an education support person if a particular student was funded, and they would only be funded to come into certain classes. It might be English or maths. Rarely would they come into, say, French class or a humanities or history class. So, you know, there's a bunch of things that make it hard for teachers to respond in the ideal way, you know, and to be as flexible as and knowledgeable as you would want.
Alice, it's really interesting to hear you talk about the need for more teaching assistance. I mentioned that I'm doing research with primary school age children at the moment, and one of the things that we're hearing from children is that they think their school their experience of school would be better if there were more teaching assistants, because what we're hearing from them is that they really want and need more one-on-one time. So I think that's something that the children are feeling as well as teachers. But we're also facing some really serious challenges in terms of teacher retention in Australia. And despite popular myths, teachers work very long hours, they're not very well remunerated, and they're not very well valued for their work. Percy, I'd like to hear from you what we can do to start to turn this around, both in terms of immediate steps, but also longer-term reform or perhaps transformation of the system to retain teachers and to make education a really valued profession that it should be.
Yeah, I think first of all, I think I have to comment some of the things that Alice was explaining. You know, first of all, I think that the teachers should not be the first ones to ask what are how they are going to are trying to make the education more equitable, because what we know from the research from the last half a century really is that the family background is far more for powerful explainer of students learning or lack of it in the school than most people think. We also know that teachers account about 10% of the variability of the students learning or measured learning in the school, and about 60% of this variability is outside of the school gate, which basically means that if we really want to improve the education outcomes here in Australia, we need to look at the system level issues, which directly goes to the policy environment and what people can do outside of the school. So I think that, you know, going back to your question now, I think that, you know, this is one of those conditions that we need to stop expecting that teachers can do miracles in a school when they obviously don't have resources and facilities to do that. We heard about the lack of teaching assistance. If you have a classroom of 25 where you have 10 kids with the special educational needs or anything that they would be benefiting from teaching assistance or more individualized approach or something like this, but you know, if the schools can't do that, it's not that the teachers can do those. That's what the system needs to provide, those things. And you know, more we kind of expect teachers to do miracles and work against the impossible, which is the inequalities in an unequal society like Australia or many others. That's just doing working against all these expectations and wishes that we have to have more young people going into teaching. So we need to be realistic in terms of what we can expect, and the teachers can do much more when it comes to making teaching and learning interesting in the schools and classrooms, building these relationships with the young people that Alice was talking about, that are extremely important things. But the teachers can't and schools can't really, you know, do away these barriers that often exist with many, many young people when they come to school that are linked to more the community or family where they happen to live in. And that's why this, you know, I understand this equity thing is such an important thing. It's also important for making sure that we have a realistic expectations from what our teachers can do and what they can't.
Can I just second that? I think absolutely. We can look at the micro elements of the classroom, but in the end, a school is not a silo. It's so interconnected with every other aspect of our society and economy. And I think the big picture is so important.
I think that's the perfect place for us to stop and go to a break. But listening, Alice and Percy, to the things that you're saying, it strikes me just the importance of thinking about the way in which systems are not working. And one of the things I think that is so striking is that the way in which every social problem that we have often gets moved into schools to resolve, you know, and they're issues that no other part of society is able to solve. So to expect schools to do that with the resources they have is simply unrealistic at best, but an enormous burden on teachers as well. But let's pick some of that up after the break. So please don't go away. We'll be back with Alice Garner and Percy Solberg in just a moment.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Welcome back. We're here with Percy Solberg and Alice Gardner talking about how we address the challenges that are facing the education system. And before the break, I was having flashbacks to the conversations that we've had over the course of this year when we've looked at complex problems like biodiversity, climate change, and the health system, and our temptation to look at the microcosm of those systems that really fails to address the big picture, teaching, of course, being a small part of the social network of our lives. So I can't wait to hear what our two guests will continue our conversation with today and what sort of solutions they might offer us. But before we go there, Alice, I'd love to hear your reflections on your career through education. You mentioned at the beginning that you entered teaching as a career change teacher, someone who has an established career, who moves into teaching and brings a wealth of professional and life experience with her. Attracting more career change teachers is often identified as one means of attracting more people into teaching profession. But what was your experience as a career change teacher? And if you're comfortable, perhaps you could share with us some of the reasons why you decided to leave the profession.
Yeah, sure. The funny thing is that when I was young, it never would have dawned on me to become a teacher, even though I actually enjoyed school. I went through the government school system in Victoria. I went to a lot of different schools, about 9 actually, so I got a good taste of many different schools. But, you know, as in my 20s and 30s, it never occurred to me to go into teaching. But then I had children. I had 3 children and, they went to school. And when my daughter, my oldest child, was in grade 5, and, you know, that conversation started about what school are you sending your child to, and I just started getting really cross. It was like, well, she's going to go to the local high school. And what I realized was that this was not what you were supposed to say or do, you know, and without wanting to go too far into the big elephant in the room of the public-private problem, I actually decided that I wanted to get involved in reconnecting our local community with our local high school. And so I got very involved in that in a voluntary capacity as a parent and community member. And that experience of kind of connecting with the school and of helping to very slowly, but, you know, over a number of years, the enrollments grew and it's become a much more sort of popular and, the enrollment's gone right up. They've got a new building. Yeah, anyway, that's a whole other story. But essentially, I got very interested in education and schools and how they work and their connection with communities as well. And as a result, I thought, oh, I actually think I want to see what it's like in a classroom now. Maybe I'll go and do some teacher training. And, you know, and I kind of felt almost shy or embarrassed to tell people about this for some reason, which I think we probably all know, which is, you know, the way that teaching is talked about in the media and so forth. But I actually did it, and I went and got my teaching qualification, got a job as a French and humanities teacher in a secondary school in Melbourne, and sort of threw myself in the deep end and discovered initially, you know, it's such an exciting job. It's, I don't think people who haven't taught may not realize how intellectually stimulating it is. And I have a PhD in history. I'd had it for a number of years, and I'd worked in academia. So, you know, it's not like I'd been bored before, but I was just really amazed at what it threw at me, the questions that came, the work with the young people, but also the collaborations with my colleagues. And that was another element that was wonderful. Like the rapport and the work that teachers do together is quite extraordinary, I think. So I loved all of that. But I quickly also realized how demanding this job would be. And over the next few years, I guess I realized it was going to completely swallow up my life, and I would never have time to do other things that I've always done, like play music, you know, all sorts of other things that I like to do. So it was this kind of double bind of what an extraordinary profession, but it's going to kill me. And so, look, after 5 years, even though I loved it in many, many ways, I also thought if I keep going like this, I'm actually going to burn out just from exhaustion. And so I stopped. And it was partly also because my daughter said, "We never see you. You know, maybe you should think about another job." So I took leave. And that's really why I left. But there are all sorts of other little reasons that, you know, play into that. But essentially, I guess what I want to say is, you know, I think there is a desire out there for people to become teachers. People are drawn to education, but they have a lot of questions, and legitimate questions about, you know, can I survive in that profession? Because I hear that it just knocks people out. So that's in a nutshell my experience. I was the classic person who lasted 5 years and then had to go. I may go back, but not until things change.
Alice, I think that's such a powerful summary of all of the challenges within Australia's education system and how that then impacts on teachers and what it means for not just their profession but their lives. Pasi, you've studied and you've written about the Finnish education system. And, of course, that's a system that's often held up as being a world-leading system. What can Australia learn from the Finnish approach to teaching and learning? And particularly, what can we learn in terms of reforming some of the systems that are failing us?
Good question. We need to be very careful not to pick wrong things that are very difficult to translate from another culture like Finland to Australia. But I think, you know, if we remain in this teacher and teaching theme, I think, you know, one of those things that is keeping the situation in Finland very different when it comes to retaining teachers. You know, we have a system there where once you get your teacher qualifications from the university and go teaching, you normally never leave. Very few people actually leave the profession, and people often ask that, why is that, and why the teacher education is so popular and common among young people to seek for the lifelong career. It's often comes down to seeing and developing teaching as a profession, which is not always the case in other countries, that meaning that it can really be compared to the other high professions like what medical doctors do, or lawyers, or architects, or designers, or others, that there's a certain amount of professional autonomy. In Finland, we call it a collective autonomy, which means that teachers have autonomy from the bureaucracy and administration, but less autonomy from one another. That is seen as a kind of a collective profession. But probably one thing that really stands higher than anything else when it comes to that very professional space where teachers work is trust, that teachers are trusted since they are professionals. They are trusted by parents, but they are particularly trusted by politicians. And, you know, some of those comments and things, reactions I've seen here in Australia during my time by some of the politicians and political leaders, you could never, ever hear in Finland because of the that would be a violation of the kind of a professional code. And that's, you know, when the young people in Finland, when they realize that teachers are professionals and they are respected and trusted in their own judgments and, you know, including evaluating how and what the students are learning, like in this country here and many others, we have these standardized external tests that will qualify and justify how well kids learn. In Finland, is all about, you know, it's a teacher's responsibility. And it has created a teaching, the kind of ethos of teaching in Finland that is a very attractive. It's a creative job and it's a knowledge, you know, it's a knowledge-based profession. And I would also say that when I look at the most recent commentary by some of the education system leaders here, where they are insisting that teachers in Australia have to rely everything they do in a classroom on evidence, and the teachers have to, you know, look for evidence and then share it with others. It's just a just something that is very hard for me as a Finnish born and Finnish raised teacher to understand, because in Finland we tend to think that teaching is as much a performing art, it's an art form, than it is a science, kind of a scientific craft. And for some people, I know many teachers in Finland who think that teaching is primarily kind of a performing art form, informed by science. And that's, you know, if we see teaching as a creative, interesting, collective profession where people have much more time to work together and think about how to do things better in a school. Unlike here, it's no wonder that young people still continue to seek teaching as their dream lifelong career in a country like Finland. And there's some other countries as well. But it's almost like a day and night, the difference between how people experience the teaching profession in some countries compared to what it is here.
That's really quite powerful, the idea of teaching as using science and imagination. Alice, earlier we talked about time pressure on teachers, and I think the story that you told about your experience working as a teacher, the passion that you brought in, and then the reasons why you left were quite profound. I'm wondering what changes are needed for teachers to be able to focus their energies on teaching and learning. I wonder if you have a list, perhaps, of the essential changes that might bring someone with your skills back into the classroom.
Yeah, look, I was delighted at what Pasi was just saying then about, you know, in a sense, I think you felt like you often had to keep proving that you were doing what you were doing by drawing on evidence, whether it was survey data from students or, you know, you were supposed to crunch numbers for, you know, assessment results and so on. And it felt like there was this constant requirement to kind of justify your existence. And that's, I felt that every moment in the classroom was professional development for me. And I would happily have gone and just sat and talked about what I was learning and the things that I knew that I needed to improve on and, you know, then go and seek out my colleagues who would know more about that for advice, and to do that in a much more, instinctive and spontaneous way, rather than it all being recorded in spreadsheets, you know, in ways that might satisfy the department or whatever. So I'd have to say that the kind of administration and record keeping that comes along with that, I guess, what you might call accountability requirements, is very frustrating for teachers. I think we all know what our strengths and weaknesses are, and most teachers are trying to do something about that in the ways that they collaborate with their colleagues. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I think, you know, Pasi mentioned the possibility of greater autonomy from administration of other kinds as well. So to give an example, I used to organise occasionally a year-level French excursion, say, to the cinema. And the paperwork that was involved in that took weeks and weeks. And I'm talking about risk assessments. I'm talking about writing consent forms, collecting consent forms, getting first aid kits together, contacting the venue, booking the tickets, paying for the tickets, pulling up purchase orders. I mean, I had to do all that stuff. And that seems to me completely insane. You know, I think my time would have been so much better spent on preparing a great set of lessons about the film that we were going to see, and activities to do with that. Instead, you know, it was pushing, it was just paperwork. And they're the kinds of things that drive teachers away, I think. That makes no sense. It's not even efficient from a sort of management perspective. So, and yet teachers spend a lot of their days doing that kind of work. So if we're talking about just sort of day-to-day things, they're some of the things that I think need to change.
We've heard from both of you very powerfully about the things that make it very difficult for teachers to actually do the job that we would want them to do, which is teaching and engaging with children. Most of the research that I do is with children and young people who are facing very tough times, from poverty to hunger to concerns about safety and social marginalisation. And many of them find school a really difficult experience. Percy, I'd love to hear from you about how we transform schools from being places that add to the challenges of some children and young people to making them sites not just of positive learning and sharing, but to making them a joyous experience that excites the imagination of children and perhaps also teachers.
Yeah, I think we need more play and more time to play in our schools and all the schools, not just the primary or preschools, but all the schools need to be much more playful. And you know, this is what we teach our children here and many other countries, is that, you know, learning and education are kind of a serious things, and kids learn very early age that education is actually mostly a kind of academic stuff rather than anything else. And, you know, that's one of those things that I've been trying to do during my time here in Australia, try to help some individual schools to change, is to just, you know, think harder about how to make a school more playful place. Because with play comes joy, with play comes the creativity and opportunities to use your imagination. And when children learn these things through play, then they are more likely to use them also when they're learning mathematics and science and music and some other things. So, and you know, this is cheap. It's a free of charge. It doesn't cost anything. It just requires a little bit, you know, thinking differently about what is education for and how children learn, and then have these good conversations with parents and adults and just do it. I've seen the transformation here at the level of the schools. So I'm a firm believer that it's doable. You know, all the 100% of schools in Finland do it. 100% of schools in Iceland do the same thing. And there are a number of countries where they are, you know, moving into this direction, bringing play back to children's lives. And through that, you know, restore this. The biggest power that we have in humans is our imagination and how to use that for learning and also for doing things differently.
Wow. So joy, creativity and imagination as core elements of the education process and of school. That's quite an extraordinary shift from an education system that perhaps has tried to damp some of these elements down. We really do have challenges that need to be grappled with in both the short and the long term. And ultimately, we need different thinking about our education system, and that the transformation that might be required won't be either quick or easy. In concluding today's conversation, I would love to hear from each of you what you think needs to happen immediately, if we were in charge right now, for us to begin the journey of education transformation in Australia. Parsi?
Yeah, let me continue from what I said previously about the play. I think it's not enough to engage teachers, you know, give them more voice and agency in developing and you know, doing this transformation. I think we really need to engage and invite our children also to be part of the leadership and be part of this change, because, you know, that's going to be there their world and life anywhere that we are talking about. And, you know, I have learned one thing here that I try to advocate and share everywhere I go, and it is that the young people in this country and all the other countries have a much more capacity to do great things for themselves and others than we give them credit for. And, you know, as long as we keep children as a customers or recipients of our efforts to transform education, we are losing a big part of the opportunity that we have. So let's find a way, like some Australian grade schools have done it, that they engage and invite children to be part of the leadership and part of this transformation, and not just those that we every now and then give a voice and ask what they think or what they would love to do, but also let them lead some of these things. I'm not saying that they should be able to do and allow them to do whatever they want to do, but they have a lot of capacity that we often ignore. And you know, unleashing this capacity of young children, I think we would be both much better off, and we could see this transformation much more faster than we should otherwise.
Wow, that's a really powerful piece of advice. Alice, what would be your first thing?
Look, having talked about the smaller stuff in the classrooms, I think we need to see a large systemic change, and that requires serious political will and courage. And I know from years ago reading Parsi's book, Finish Lessons, that kind of huge systemic change actually was what was required to create the system that is now in place. I think that's correct, right? There was actually a big picture change. And in order to make that happen, there have to be really honest conversations. It's complicated, but it's so important that we can't just keep fiddling with the edges, you know. And this is a moment of possibility, I think. So I really hope the current both federal and all state governments can sort of get it together, please.
Get it together, please. Embrace the moment in time. Thank you so much for a wonderful conversation today, Alice Garner and Parsi Sahlberg. It's been wonderful hearing from the two of you, their perspective on the education system and the prospects for change. I feel inspired. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Anna-Greta, that was a fantastic conversation. You know, so much of what both Alice and Parsi said resonated with the research that I'm doing at the moment, and really powerful points from both of them. But what did you think about that conversation?
Oh, I thought the strength of having the two of them side by side was really quite extraordinary. Entwining the two strands of both the comparative experience with the Finnish education system and the lived experience of someone who was really interested in contributing as a teacher in the Victorian education system. It was wonderful to hear both the highlights of the education system and the really significant challenges. And I'm hearing again some recurring themes that have come up in both our previous conversations about education, but also themes that were there through our healthcare system discussions and even through our environment systems discussions. I'm hearing conversations around how we value our relationships, the human connection, the time that it takes to build those relationships, and the immense reward and value that we could give to the relationship between teacher and student, between teachers within an education system, and the creativity that can come when we value and resource teachers as remarkable professionals that they are. What were your thoughts, Sharon?
Yeah, look, similarly to you, Anna-Greta, those themes that we keep coming back to on the pod, almost whatever topic we're talking about of care, of time and relationships, I thought was so powerful. I really loved Percy's last point, and I'm so glad he made it, that we need to start listening to children, that we need to engage children and young people in deciding what a vision of our education system should be. You know, and as you know, and many of our listeners know, Anna-Greta, a lot of the research that I do is around listening to children and understanding what the world is from their perspective. And we hear again and again, often how much children love school, how much they care for their teachers, but also the ways in which it's failing them. And the pressures that we heard Alice and Parsi talk about are also felt by children and young people. So we really need to start listening to what works in the classroom for children and what doesn't, and be guided by that. Now, a few years ago, I was involved in a study funded by the Australian Research Council that was led by Professor Anne Graham at Southern Cross University. And in that study, we found that being able to fully participate in school, not just attending, but being engaged in school and participating in decision making, significantly enhanced children's well-being. And at the moment, we're talking all about well-being. So that is such an important finding from that study. And that study and other work shows the enormous capability of children to be able to engage in these complex conversations about what works for them and what works for society. And, of course, that's so often all about human relationships. But I hear Alice talking about what teachers have to do, and it's simply impossible to form relationships. In the research that we do with children, what we hear from children is that how much they loved it and how much they enjoyed being listened to. And we often hear children say things like, I've got so much to say, but no one ever listens. And part of the reason for that is, as you pointed out, Anna-Greta, time. The research that we do, we will have 10 children in a room with perhaps 3 or 4 researchers. I cannot imagine the pressures on teachers when there is one of them and 25 or 30 children. It's not possible to build relationships. It's not possible to give children time. And it's not possible to engage imagination or joy or play. And we can't even get close to talking about equity unless we first deal with those things. So we've got some real challenges. If we had the political will, there is a map, there is a clear pathway forward. We just have to commit to it.
They're really, really powerful points, and it's an extraordinary framework. I am going to go back to the hashtag valuing care. These are choices that we make in our policy space as to how we value time, how we value resources, how we value relationships, how we value play, and how we value imagination. We make the choices today that will influence our future, a future which is less certain than the time that we're in now. So, listeners, we will leave a link to the publications that we've discussed in the show notes on policyforum.net. We love hearing from our audience, so please reach out to us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum, or you can send us an email to podcast@policyforum.net, or you can join our Facebook group, Policy Forum Pod. From me, Anna-Greta Hunter, see you next week.
And from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.